This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Just about everybody's familiar with the food pyramid, the federal government's trusty pictorial guide for nutritional health that showcases the four major food groups in order of importance and proportion. Recently, the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced that the 12-year-old visual aid is under review. Come early next year, the guide will be revamped and could lose its triangular shape altogether. The overhaul is partly a response to new science, but it also reflects a judgment that the pyramid has failed. While studies show that 80% of Americans recognize the food pyramid, few of us follow its recommendations, as evidenced by our thickening waistlines. Change will not come easily or without controversy. The revamping process involves several key players, not to mention the general eating public, and the stakes are very high. This hour we'll hear from some of those players, the USDA, a nutritionist, the food industry, and the medical community, to try to make sense of the competing messages about what we eat. Later in the program, a proposal in France to relabel wine as food. But first, the geometry of food politics. Does the good old pyramid help you decide what to eat, or does it confuse you? In fact, do you pay any attention to it at all? What might work better for you and the way you eat? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now by phone from the U.S. Department of Agriculture offices here in Washington is Eric Henches, the executive director of the USDA's Center for Nutrition Policy and Promotion, the group that's in charge of changing the food pyramid. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
So what was the balance in deciding to revamp the food pyramid? Was it new science, or was it the fact that most of us have had to let out our belts a few notches over the past 20 or 30 years?
Well, that's a good question. If you look at the history of food guidance at USDA, it really goes back to 1916. So this is not something new. It has been an evolutionary item throughout the last 100 years, basically. In 1992, that food guidance at USDA became the food guide pyramid. And so we're 12 years or so into this particular phase of food guidance. And you're right, the science, we have new science. The National Academy of Sciences Institute of Medicine has published the new dietary reference intakes. We have new national consumption survey data on foods. We have new food composition data. And we are in the midst of revising the dietary guidelines, which is the federal policy. So all those items come together and give us the impetus for revising our food guidance, or revising the current food guide pyramid.
Well, the pyramid is an important kind of message. As you say, it's been out there for 12 years, but it's not the only message that we get, that we're eating too much and not exercising enough. Are we just flying in the face of all of this advice, or is it the advice that the government has been giving us has been wrong?
I would say, indeed, it is not that the advice has been wrong. In fact, I think if we look at the previous five editions of dietary guidelines and the food guidance, they are all based on sound science, consensus process for looking at the latest literature and moving forward every 5 years with updated policy and with updated guidance. You're right, though, that there is challenges when it comes to food. And I think if we look at a lot of consumer research and we look at the hierarchy of decision-making, quite often we see that taste, convenience, price, and then, oh, by the way, nutrition comes in a third or fourth in some of our hierarchy of decision-making.
Marketing plays a factor in some of that, too.
Well, it feeds into that hierarchy of decision-making. And so the challenge and the opportunity for us with new policy and a new guidance system is to be able to get a better implementation and to move that issue of health higher up on the decision chart.
As you go ahead in this process, I know you're trying to get the public involved to update the food pyramid. Explain the initiative. You're looking for a more effective message.
Yes, we are going out right now. We currently, on July 13th, published a new Federal Register notice asking the public to comment on issues of how we motivate people, how we have education programs, and then how do we put this into actionable tools to be able to get a more effective and efficient implementation. So I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about that. People can find this Federal Register notice and how they comment by going to our website at USDA, and that is www.cnpp.usda.gov.
And for those of you who's don't have a pencil handy, we'll copy down that information and put it on our website on the Talk of the Nation page and give you a link to that website there. So you just go to the Talk of the Nation page at npr.org, which might be easier to remember.
Okay. Yes, I think so. I appreciate it.
Now, as you look at the pyramid as it's presently constituted, what do you see that's wrong with it?
Well, what we wound up with is that people could understand the message of variety, that there was a variety of foods that you needed to eat, and that there was a proportionality that you couldn't eat them all in the same amount. One of the things that was missed, though, was that you never got to choose the highest range if you were a lower calorie level. In other words, that whole issue that you have to stay within your caloric budget as you start your food choices was part of the original pyramid, but the message didn't come through strong enough. And it's obvious when we have two-thirds overweight and obesity that this has got to be a front-and-center message as we revise our communications here.
Another problem is trying to get one emblem or one simple thing that fits so many different kinds of people.
Yes, that's a great point. We know that we cannot have a one-size-fits-all program, and that's, again, one of the items that we sort of got pegged with the current pyramid. And that's part of that Federal Register notice. We're asking comments on how do we individualize and personalize this guidance. And we're talking not about a single program, but we talk about in that Federal Register notice, how do we put it into a system so that we can take into account ethnic and cultural and philosophical needs, so that as well as age and gender needs, to be able to personalize this guidance.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address, TOTN at NPR.org. Our guest is Eric Henches, the executive director of the USDA's Center for Nutrition Policy and Promotion, the group that's in charge of the revision of the food pyramid. Michael joins us on the line from San Jose, California.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm on a cell phone. I just hope it doesn't drop the call.
We do, too.
I wanted to comment that when I was a child in the 70s, grammar school age, I remember a program, I think it might have been on PBS, I'm not sure, but it was called Mulligan Stew, and it recommended a dietary plan of 4-4-3-2, which broke down into 4 servings of fruits and vegetables, 4 servings of bread and cereals, 3 of meat, fish, and dairy, meat, fish, and protein, and 2 of dairy. And that still works for me. I don't follow it religiously, but at that age, it made me aware of balancing my diet, and I still do that. I just pay attention to what kind of variety I'm eating.
Eric Henches, everybody, I guess, gets a different signal from something different.
Well, I think the Michael's point is well taken, that if we can implement these things in the appropriate manner early on, there are those that will adopt it and make it a lifestyle issue. And this is kind of the key. What I hear the caller saying is that they have put this into their whole lifestyle. It can't be just something you do for a little while. You need to have the flexibility and the individual, you know, usefulness of it to be able to make it in your lifestyle. And I'm encouraged by the caller's comment. It has worked for them.
And Michael, has it worked for you? Are you today overweight?
No, not at all.
Well, congratulations.
I always had trouble putting weight on.
But, we now hate you, Michael.
Sorry.
Bye-bye.
I did have one other question. Whether the 4-4-3-2, how that relates to the pyramid as it stands, or the revisions that have come up. And I can take that comment off the air.
Okay, Michael, thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, regarding that, we had a previous Federal Register notice September of last year. And that the comments, and we had in there the technical basis for the revision, the scientific basis. And in there are the proposed food patterns at different calorie levels for different age and gender usage. And so all of that information on the proposed revisions of the pattern can be found, again, on our website from that Federal Register notice of last year.
And again, you can find the link to that after the show. We'll put it up on the Talk of the Nation webpage. Let's talk now with Peter, who's with us from Arkwright, New York.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, I believe the inception of the food period was basically brought on by big business in the meat and dairy industry. And I'm trying to practice vegetarianism and veganism, and also have an organic garden in my backyard that we mostly eat out of. Wouldn't it be wonderful, because the world really needs to eat healthy, that the best way to really eat is vegetarianism? And I've been over in India, where much of the country is actually gone into vegetarianism, and it's really a wonderful thing. And if we thought about what really runs the food in our supermarket, what brings us there, it really is just another corporate big business. I'll take it off the air.
Okay, Peter, thanks for the call. Eric Henches?
Well, the idea of being able to have a vegetarian pattern is obviously important to a significant group of consumers in America. And that is part of making sure that our future guidance does take into account, again, that individualized and personalized. And if you wish to have a vegetarian pattern, that we need to show how the substitutions work, and that the substitution of legumes, nuts, and stuff for animal products, where you get your calcium if you're not going to be partaking in dairy products.
What about the other point that he made, though, about the influence of the food industry in developing guidelines and the food pyramid?
Well, I think that's important on the fact that for the first time, USDA is using the Federal Register notice. So for everything is an open, transparent process. So we published the first notice on this. This is the science. This is where it's coming from. These are the standards we're using. This is the national database we're using to get comments on that. So anybody can comment. And it worked very well. We got over 255 letters of comments from a wide variety of people, including all the nutrition professional societies, other federal agencies, diet and health foundations and organizations, as well as the food industry. And now we're coming back with the education, motivation, and graphic, and asking for the input from the public at large. So all of the comments, all the consensus is all on the website and done through the Federal Register notice and comment.
And we're going to be hearing from some of those other interest groups when we come back from a short break. But Eric Henches, thank you very much for your time today.
I sure appreciate the opportunity.
Eric Henches, Executive Director of the USDA's Center for Nutrition Policy and Promotion, with us by phone from the USDA's offices in Washington. We're talking about the food pyramid. 800-989-8255. TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about proposed revisions to the food pyramid and the factors that go into federal health policy. If you'd like to take a look at the current food pyramid, as well as Asian and Mediterranean versions of it, which some say are healthier alternatives, they're on our website at npr.org. And of course, we'd like you involved in the conversation. What role do you think government should play in the promotion of good nutrition? Is the food pyramid not enough? Or do you think nutrition is a private choice rather than a public concern? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Many in the nutrition community have taken issue with the food pyramid from the get-go. Joining us now here in Studio 3A is Michael Jacobson, Executive Director of the Center for Science in the Public Interest, a nonprofit lobbying group here in Washington. Good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil.
What criticisms do you have of the current food pyramid, and do you think it's based on good science?
The food pyramid has been reviled by nutritionists since the day it came out. And the basic reason is that it fails to distinguish good and bad foods within a given category.
Mm-hmm.
So there's ice cream and skim milk in the same group.
In the dairy group.
In the dairy group. There's hot dogs and lentils in the protein group. There's white bread and whole wheat bread in the grain group. It just doesn't make sense. It doesn't provide really useful advice.
Well, one of the criticisms of it is that it is too confusing as it is. Are you going to make it more confusing?
Well, I think it could actually be made much simpler by, in the grain group, indicating that they're talking about whole grains and really emphasize that. For the if there's going to be a dairy group or a calcium group, it should say skim milk or low-fat dairy products or soy, the calcium-fortified soy products, and not put in cheese and ice cream that we ought to be eating a lot less of. Leave the hot dogs and the hamburgers out of the protein group and emphasize lean chicken, beans, and so on. So I think it could actually be made simpler. But perhaps the most important thing is that regardless of what the pyramid turns into, maybe a square, a circle, a mm-hmm. rectangle, it probably doesn't matter very much because it hasn't had much of an impact. The government goes through these agonizing ordeals every 5 or 10 years, comes up with refinements on its previous advice. There's hoopla in the newspaper, and then it just sits there for the next 5 years. This government ought to be terribly concerned about the health impact of the current American diet. What we're eating has caused an obesity epidemic and also tremendous amounts of heart disease, high blood pressure and stroke, cancer, diabetes, you know, this whole range of problems. But the government does virtually nothing in terms of mass media campaigns, say, to encourage people to eat less meat and eat more legumes or drink less soda pop. It hasn't adopted any real policies to change the foods in the supermarket. Let me give you one example
mm-hmm.
that doesn't really show up on the pyramid yet, but partially hydrogenated vegetable oil contains trans fat. In the last 15 years, it's been discovered that trans fat is probably the worst fat in the food supply, worse than the saturated fat in butter, for instance. With one stroke of the pen, the Food and Drug Administration can get rid of partially hydrogenated vegetable oil. We asked it to do that last May. It could save tens of thousands of lives a year by doing that. But it's not, and it probably won't, because that would offend the cookie industry, the cracker industry, the fast food industry, and a whole bunch of other industries. Another thing that would save tens of thousands of lives a year would be to reduce the sodium content in foods, forcing companies to use less salt. Just getting back to the amount of sodium from salt that we consumed 20 or 30 years ago would save thousands and possibly tens of thousands of lives. But the government, and I think this government under Bush is particularly culpable, but Clinton wasn't much better. Government has a hard time doing anything because it flies in the face of all of these food lobbies, and senators and members of Congress from farm states or soda pop producing areas and so on.
Let's get some listeners back in the conversation. Scott is on the line with us from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
But thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I don't have trouble with the food pyramid. I've always used it as a guideline. that I could wander away from or adhere tightly to, and it's worked well for us, but it was easily understood. With regards to the conversation about changing it and making more specific, you can make something foolproof, but you can't make it damn foolproof. my wife and I, we eat a lot of grains. We do tend to stay away from ice cream. We're heavy into vegetables and fruits, but we eat fish and that sort of thing. It's always been a good guideline for us, and we're in reasonably good health.
Okay, Scott.
I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, so the sum is that it works for you.
And that's it in summation, yeah.
And do you feel like, what works for an individual works for an individual, doesn't it, Michael Jacobson?
Well, I think it works for him because he knows how to interpret it. It sounds like from the protein group, he's not eating the hot dogs and hamburgers that are a lot more popular with Americans than fish. He's not, from the dairy group, he's not eating too much ice cream, but choosing skim milk.
Is that a fair summation of what you're doing, Scott?
It's a fair summation, and we're relatively immune to advertising. And I know there are people who, corporate America, just dropping their pencils. There are people who are immune to it. We tend to stay away from fast food. It's a rare event when we go out to a fast food joint, and then we tend to work low on the list. That's when we wander away from it. But we, our day-to-day guy—it's become so internalized with my wife and I that we no longer give it much thought when we do our food budget or what have you. And we just prefer to eat the whole grains. I don't think we're a food fetish in any ways, but we just pretty much ignore the advertising that we see.
I think he also ignores the food guide pyramid, you know, that says, go ahead and eat the white bread and the hot dogs and the ice cream.
Oh, every once in a while.
All right, Scott. Thanks very much, and good for you.
Thank you.
All right, let's get another caller in. Linda from Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Hi, Neil. I love your show.
Thank you so much.
Okay, I've got an idea instead of the food pyramid to have a food wheel. And the outer wheel would be male or female. Then you could have another wheel, age. Another meal, a wheel, your weight, and then in the center it could give you suggestions on how much and what you should eat.
Might that be a better presentation and a more convincing presentation for people, Michael Jacobson?
I don't know if it would or not. You know, there are all kinds of designs out there, and I don't think that there's a design that's going to be clever enough to persuade tens of millions of Americans to ignore the billions of dollars worth of advertising, all the junk food that's available everywhere, and be dedicated to eating a good diet. You know, nutrition isn't terribly complicated when you get down to it. It's basing a diet on whole grains, fruits and vegetables, having beans, maybe having some low-fat animal products, unless you're a vegetarian, and that's it. You know, that's what you should eat. And if you eat occasional candy bar or a dish of ice cream, you'll survive. And whether that goes into an hourglass or a pyramid or concentric circles, I don't think it matters.
But how do you convince people to do that?
I think you need massive education campaigns. The government, look, diet is, for non-smokers, diet is the biggest cause of heart disease and cancer. The biggest cause. What's the government doing? Coming up with a pyramid or a circle? It doesn't matter. It's got to get that message out with hard-hitting mass media campaigns, spending real money, $100 million, $200 million a year, which the Pentagon would laugh at. I mean, it's not real money for the Pentagon, but invest in real campaigns. And the other thing is to change food and farm policies. Farmers could be paid more if their dairy cows produced milk lower in saturated fat. That would help get saturated fat out of the food supply. Government needs to adopt those policies and massive educational campaigns. And if it comes up with an hourglass or two concentric circles, fine. But that's not really what's going to change the American diet.
Linda, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Here's this email from Sarah Lemire. I hope I'm not mispronouncing that, in Cleveland. Revising the food pyramid is fine, but it won't make changes in obesity. She says most people know what they need to do to stay healthy. However, people who don't have a lot of money tend not to eat well because the price of fresh foods and healthy foods are much more expensive than unhealthy foods. Maybe the focus should not be on revising guidelines, but should be on making healthy foods more accessible cost-wise to everyone.
Well, I'd vote for that. We need to do that. We need to figure out what are policies that can help bring health, make healthy foods cheaper and maybe less healthy foods more expensive. Should some foods be taxed and those taxes be used to subsidize fruits and vegetables? Should food stamp recipients get bonus food stamps to allow them to eat more fruits and vegetables? Senator Harkin has had a wonderful program that so far it's very tiny, but it provides one serving of a free fruit or vegetable to children in about 100 schools every day throughout the year.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful way of getting kids to eat more of the foods they should be eating.
Let me ask you finally about the effect of the food lobby. These are obviously the food industry is affected by government policy, that government policy comes out. It also provides the country food, provides for an awful lot of jobs also, obviously. Should the food industry have a seat at this table?
Well, I think everybody deserves a seat. Nobody should be shut out of the room. I don't think industry has to worry. Most of the USDA officials in charge of this thing are former industry officials. Mr. Henches, who you had on.
Used to work for the pork council.
Beef industry, to boot. Industry gets its say. Don't worry about that. The question is, who's making the decisions, and will the average person get its say? I think the government this time around, notwithstanding those industry influences, will do a better job than it has in the past. I'm hopeful, both on this, on the food guidance and on that dietary guidelines for Americans that Mr. Henches talked about. Whatever those documents say, though, they will sit on a shelf. They will gather dust. They have to be turned into policies.
And that's a matter of political will and Congress.
That's right. And the administration. You know, this administration doesn't care about it. Not many administrations have. It has to, the government has to get in there and say, this is so important. This is the health of the public. Do we want people to be dying prematurely of diet-related diseases? Do we want teenagers to be developing adult-onset diabetes or not?
Well, as you point out, you say this administration's not doing well. I didn't hear an awful lot about this in Boston last week.
There was nothing. And during the Clinton administration, there certainly wasn't very much coming out there. And it's partly because the food industry is bipartisan. The farm states are, they have a lot of Democrats and a lot of Republicans. In a lot of urban areas, the supermarket industry is powerful. Different manufacturers are powerful. So it's a tough problem. The odds are against making real progress, but Center for Science and the Public Interest and many others are working towards that.
Michael Jacobson is executive director of that group. He joined us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Neil.
We're talking about the revisions to the food pyramid. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Starches comprise the coveted bottom portion of the food pyramid. The pyramid recommends you eat up to 11 servings of that a day. Foods rich in carbohydrates have been maligned by proponents of the Atkins diet and could lose their standing in federal guidelines, whatever shape it takes, come next year. Joining us now by phone from Ocean City, Maryland, is Nicholas Pyle, president of the Independent Bakers Association, a lobbying group which represents over 400 wholesale bakeries. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Since the pyramid's inception, your industry has enjoyed, by all measures, a very comfortable spot at the base of the pyramid. Has that been a boon to business?
It's been, I don't know if we could ally our bread sales based on our role at the base of the pyramid. Certainly it's an advantageous spot, and it's a coveted spot, and it's one that the other industries have sought, and there's a lot of discussion about the food guide pyramid, as plainly evident from your show today.
Yeah, and a lot of people have been critical of the baked goods industry, I guess most recently reflected in the Atkins craze. Does that make wherever it is you find yourselves in a new pyramid or whatever geometrical shape we're talking about, does that make that even more important?
Well, Atkins is certainly been a good thing for the health and nutrition of America in a lot of respects. Anything that helps people recognize their personal responsibility and their physical well-being is a good thing in my eye. I don't think that eliminating carbs entirely from your diet is necessarily a good thing to do, and it has had a deleterious impact on our industry.
So you have a big stake in this.
Absolutely.
To what extent is your organization involved in the conversation? What are you doing?
Well, we've been on a number of media opportunities such as this to talk about the role of grain-based foods in the diet and why it's important to have carbohydrates. That's what marathon runners have the night before the big race, and that's how you build energy, and carbs are a very important part of your diet. We're advocating the message of the role of carbs in the diet. We're working with USDA and submitting comments right now for both of the nutrition dietary guidelines that you've talked about, as well as what the food guide pyramid may or may not morph into.
Mm-hmm. Are the people in the baked goods industry talking about more whole grains, as so many nutritionists talk about, or the processed foods that so many are critical of?
Well, what we've seen is some declines in your white pan bread sales. One company reported a 7% decline, but what we're seeing is a growth in carb-controlled or carb-aware products, which are premium breads, which basically you take the starches out and you replace them with proteins and fats and oils, and a lot of the sources of that are chickpeas and garbanzo beans. And my bakers, at our last meeting, were talking about how unit sales of these carb-controlled items were starting to decline, whereas they were new products coming in, and they generated a lot of sales. But white pan bread sales will continue to maintain a steady role in our industry in terms of as long as moms know that kids are going to be eating their sandwiches that go to school on white pan breads, they're going to continue to make sure that that's what Junior takes in their lunchbox.
Yeah, we only have just a few seconds left, but isn't the white pan bread the least expensive version of this and also perhaps the least healthy?
Bread is a fungible commodity, and often the shopper will reach for the least expensive loaf on the aisle. That white pan bread is loaded with folic acid, which is we've seen since folate was mandated in enriched grain products, a 26% decline in neural tube defects. We don't have beriberi. We don't have the scurvy. We don't have a number of the diseases that were prevalent in the early 1920s and 30s before we started enriching bread. So there are important things in that white pan bread, iron, niacin, thiamine, a lot of vitamins that have been mandated over the years, because that's an excellent delivery point. And you're eating bread. We're a bread-based society today.
Nicholas Pyle, thanks for taking the time out to speak with us today.
Thank you.
Nicholas Pyle, president of the Independent Bakers Association, a lobbying group which represents over 400 wholesale bakeries, with us from Ocean City, Maryland. We'll have more on this after a break. I'm Neil Conan, Talk of the Nation, NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're discussing the U.S. food pyramid now, U.S. food pyramid, and joining us now is Dr. Arthur Frank, medical director of the George Washington University Weight Management Program. He's with us by phone from his office in Washington, D.C., and we'd like to hear from you of what you think of the food pyramid and if it should be changed. 800-989-8255 or email us TOTN@npr.org. And Dr. Frank, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
You're trying to tackle one aspect of nutrition, curbing obesity. In your work, what has made it difficult to get people on the path to good health? And does the food pyramid play any role?
The food pyramid has a potential for playing, well, the food equivalent pyramid has a potential for playing a great role, except that people are very confused because they're getting a lot of mixed messages. There are a lot of very dedicated interest groups that are pushing their own particular agenda, which is perfectly reasonable, because there are a lot of diverse opinions about how this should be done. And it's not that any one of them is right or any one of them is wrong. There are a whole bunch of compromises that we have to make. Public policy is just that. Public policy is the art of making a series of compromises. I think that what is happening, though, is that individuals, my patients, the consumer out there is getting a lot of confusing messages from a lot of diverse people, and as a result, tends to ignore the whole process, or tends to be indifferent to the whole process and says, I don't know what is the best thing to do. And people have different personal agendas. Some people are trying to cut calories, and some people are trying to avoid heart disease, and some people are trying to get more calcium, and some people want to cut their salt down. So there are a lot of different things that people want to do. The task for public policy people is to present this in a way that can accommodate the diversity of the American public, the diversity of their needs, and can accept a certain level of compromise among the warring factions here who are each trying to accomplish their own mission.
And what's the role of the doctor in this? Isn't the medical community's role to cut through this Gordian knot of confusion?
Well, my role is to deal with one patient at a time, and so I have the luxury of being able to adapt my recommendations to the individual and the kind of message that patient needs. If you need to cut calories, you need to do this. If you need to deal with your high cholesterol, you need to do that. They're not necessarily inconsistent, but there's a different flavor to the message, and there's a different emphasis that I want to create. The food pyramid is ultimately a very useful concept, but people, as the speakers have said, and Dr. Jacobson particularly said, that people tend to ignore it, and they tend to ignore it not because it's wrong, but because they're getting so much diversity of opinion from so many different sources, they don't know who to believe. Mm-hmm. I think that all these wonderful agencies, these wonderful lobbyists, and these public policy people really have an obligation to try to create a message that they can all support. And then the public will listen to it, will hear it, will understand it, and we can get a message that everyone will stand behind, reasonably stand behind, and then I think we can create a public policy, and we really can create change.
Well, let's get another listener on the line. Emily's with us from Tucson, Arizona.
Hi.
Hi.
I was actually calling because my biggest complaint about the food pyramid is the serving sizes. I don't know how big a serving size is, and if you look at the food pyramid, if you're eating the minimum number of servings of everything, it comes out to something like 12 servings a day, which just seems like a lot. And I know that when you go to a restaurant, you get all of these huge portions, and I was just wondering how portion size and serving size affects all of this.
Serving size is very confusing in the pyramid because it's defined differently for each individual item, and it may seem like you're getting a lot of servings, but the servings for many items on the pyramid are actually very small servings, much smaller than you'd ordinarily consider to be a serving. So that's one of the things that I think that the USDA and the food pyramid people are going to have to resolve is the whole question of how they want to define, characterize, clarify serving sizes. I think you raise an interesting point, though, that the if you go to a restaurant, you get huge servings, and I think that's because the restaurant industry has finally figured out that the cost of food itself is a very small part of the cost of doing business, and they can create enormous sense of customer loyalty by giving you gigantic servings and encouraging you to think that you've got a real bargain, a real value. People tend to eat what's put in front of them, even if it's too much food. Which I think gets to another point. I think that people who are dealing with the food pyramid kind of concept are neglecting, and that is that people don't eat simply as a source of nourishment and don't eat simply as a source of good, wholesome health. They eat for pleasure. They eat for comfort. They eat because they enjoy eating and all of the social characteristics of it. And if you create a whole series of forbidden foods and a whole series of frightening foods, then I think that people will tend to ignore it because they value very much the pleasure, the comfort, the enjoyment they get from food, and we shouldn't deny people that pleasure. It's difficult enough to eat well, and if you can make it into a pleasurable, comfortable, exciting, interesting experience, it's that much more valuable.
Emily, a lot less than what you think is the answer, I think, to your question. Okay, bye-bye.
That's what you think.
Let's see if we can get another caller in. Vince, and Vince is with us from Paducah, Kentucky.
Yes, Neil, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
For your show.
Thank you.
Yeah, one thing I think what is typically overlooked, and I know us as Americans easily overlook it, but what worked for me is moderation. And I know that's easier said than done, but I'm 6'3", 32 years old, and I was always able to eat what I want and the amounts I want. And like your guest speaker said, we tend to eat what's put in front of us. But what I tried the Atkins thing, and that worked for me. I lost about 18 pounds, and now I stay roughly in the 190s, low 190s. But what I've found that's worked for me is when I lost that 16 to 18 pounds in about a month and a half, I was miserable with what I was eating. So what's worked for me to maintain my weight is just eating that in moderation instead of, I can't have a donut because that's forbidden food. Maybe have one, once a week or something. But moderation is typically what worked for me, and majorly cutting down on my soft drinks, having a glass of water.
Well, let's get a response from Michael from Dr. Frank. I mean, moderation, again, sounds good, but it's hard to stick to it.
It's very hard to stick to it because what we're trying to do, the Atkins diet works because it's a gimmicky way, my view, it's a gimmicky way of cutting down calories. You've got to cut your calories. Now, you can cut down, when you use Atkins, you can cut down your calories with a lot of foods that you like to eat, bacon and eggs. But you can have, after a while, just so much bacon and eggs, and you do want to have some toast with your bacon and eggs. So it really gets to the whole complicated business of how you're going to organize your diet, cutting down your calories, and doing it in a way that is still makes eating a pleasurable experience, because that's very important. And I don't think that we want to ignore that. I don't think we can risk neglecting that.
Mm-hmm. One aspect of the various players in this game, a conclusion we always come to is eat less and of course, exercise more. Well, that's another show for another date, but eat less. If that's the conclusion of the whatever shape this new geometry pyramid comes out to be, is the food industry going to sign on to that?
I think the food industry would. It doesn't sign on. It declines to sign on. It does so at its own peril, because what it's doing is it's creating this epidemic of obesity and the epidemic of heart disease and the epidemic of all the other consequences of eating too much. Are they willing to go along with it? I hope they're willing to go along with it, because they've got to come to some sort of compromise. If they don't come to some sort of compromise, then they will continue to sustain a problem which is ultimately not in their own best interest.
Dr. Arthur Frank, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, sir.
Dr. Frank, medical director of the George Washington University's Weight Management Program. He joined us by phone from his office here in Washington. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.